From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I read H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine, and that actually became my inspiration, my holy grail. My notion was that what if I could build a time machine and go back and tell my father what he needed to do to save his life.
A physicist finally gets his crack at time travel. That story later this hour. Today, we grab time's arrow and hitch a ride to the end of time. Also, the bleak forecast for the universe we call home, science fiction's Music of the Spheres, and far-out predictions for the human race, everything from head transplants to the colonization of Mars.
Greetings, my friends. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future.
The human race has just begun its exploration of space, so it seems too soon to spend too much time brooding about the future of life, the universe, and everything. Luckily, astrophysicists like Lawrence Krauss do some of the worrying for us. Krauss and a colleague at Case Western Reserve University have spent years asking the cosmic question, what happens next? He told Steve Paulson that the galaxy keeps on surprising us.
The new information is that it looks like it will go on expanding forever, not just expanding, but in fact expanding at a faster and faster rate, which is really surprising. It is actually totally inexplicable at the present time. We really don't know exactly what it is that's causing that repulsive force. We have some ideas. But it also means, if it's true, the future of the universe is dramatically different than we thought it would be before. And from the point of view of the future of life, unfortunately, it appears to be the worst of all possible universes to live in.
Now, why would that be? What does it matter whether the galaxies are rapidly moving apart?
To most people, it may not seem to matter what the galaxies are doing to their everyday life. And in fact, that's true. What happens to our galaxy is on a time scale that's really irrelevant for our everyday life. But if you're interested in thinking of the long-term future of life, as we learn more about the universe, we want to study the universe and learn more and more about it. And the old wisdom was that the longer we waited, the more of the universe we would see. Because after all, light travels at a finite rate. Therefore, if the universe is, say, 12 billion years old, we can only see out a certain distance because light has only had 12 billion years to travel to us, even if the universe is, say, infinite in size. If we waited longer and longer, we would see more and more of it. But in fact, in such a universe where things are accelerating, we see less and less of the universe with time because objects eventually speed up so that relative to us, they're actually traveling away at faster than the speed of light. Now, that may sound impossible, but it's not. In fact, the rules of general relativity tell us that things that are far away from us can travel with respect to us faster than the speed of light. The implication is once they are doing so, they become invisible to us. The light literally can't catch up. It leaves those objects and it never makes it to us. So if you're a scientist, that's pretty depressing because it means eventually the scientists of the far future will only be able to see our own galaxy and nearby galaxies, but we won't have the slightest clue about what's happening in the rest of the universe.
But aren't you talking about billions of years from now?
Of course I am.
It's worth noting that the Earth is only, 5 billion years old?
We're talking about 18 or 20 billion years. That's like that joke about someone who was told the sun was going to die in a few million years. He said, a few million years? Oh, no. And the person said, oh, no, it's really a few billion years. And the fellow goes, oh, good, I was worried. The point is that, yes, this is a cosmic time frame. This is not going to be relevant to us and our nearby civilization. But in fact, those of us who perhaps some people might say have nothing better to do worry about issues such as the far future of life. And the point is the time frames we're talking about are times during which the universe will look largely the same. In 18 or 20 billion years, there'll still be stars like our sun, and there'll be planets around them, and life forms and civilizations that are very similar or powered by solar power, etc. The universe will not look very different. So civilizations that live on planets much like our own, when they look out, when their astronomers look out, will literally not be able to see much of the rest of the universe. That's one thing. There's actually even a worse implication of all of this, but it takes place on a much longer time scale. We have argued that if the universe is accelerating, that in fact life ultimately has to end. Again, that may seem esoteric, and it absolutely is, but it amazes me that we can use some very basic laws of physics. Here we are sitting on a planet around a star in a remote corner of a remote galaxy in the middle of nowhere, and yet we may be able to argue about the ultimate future of life in the universe on the basis of very simple physical laws.
Because why would life end because the universe is accelerating?
Well, the point is that life requires energy. We're learning that now as more and more in our society we depend on imported fuel and eventually maybe solar power. But life requires energy to survive. And in a universe where things are moving away from us ever faster, we really have access to only a finite amount of the universe to try and get energy from. Right now we get it from our sun, later on maybe from other sources. But we know that if the universe is accelerating away from us, then basically, even in an infinite amount of time, we only have access to a finite amount of energy. That means that life, which is powered by energy, has to take that into account. And, of course, you can take it into account by conservation or by other more esoteric means. In fact, the physicist Freeman Dyson and I have been having a big debate about this. He's proposed a beautiful and cute way to try and have civilization survive as long as possible, and that's by going into hibernation for ever longer and longer periods and waking up for a short time, doing a lot, and then going back to sleep. But we've argued that even with that, in a universe which is accelerating away from us, in fact, there just won't be enough energy for life to continue doing that forever. And after a time which is truly cosmic, truly very long, life will have to end. Any civilization will die. And again, it's completely impractical from an everyday perspective. But it would be truly remarkable if we could actually prove that on the basis of simple laws of physics and on a basis of the expansion of the universe.
Now, I want to bring this discussion down to Earth. At least,
if it's possible.
Yeah, at least talking about the future of Earth itself. Now, you said that life will end if this theoretical model holds up many billions and billions of years from now. What about the Earth itself or our solar system?
Okay, well, the future of our Earth is dismal. The first kind of disaster that might befall us, if we think about the disasters of the future, is we know that our planet is bombarded regularly by large asteroids and meteors and comets. On a time frame of once every few hundred million years, on average, our Earth has been bombarded by such a large object that it causes great damage. 65 million years ago, the one that hit in what is now Central America, and we believe was responsible for helping kill off the dinosaurs.
So we're going to get smacked again at some point.
We're going to get smacked again potentially. Now, that's something we might be able to guard against with our telescopes. Right now, we know there are about 1,000 objects in the solar system that are in potential Earth-crossing orbits. And if we refine our measuring technology, we may be able to, for example, have 10 or 20 years warning before such an event would happen, in the best of all possible worlds. We might imagine a Hollywood science fiction scenario where we send up something that will deflect or destroy the object that is likely. These objects are only about 5 to 10 miles across that are likely to do all this damage. And therefore, it's not completely implausible that we might not send up some nuclear weapons or something to destroy the object, just like the recent Hollywood movies on that subject. We wouldn't do it in 2 weeks, but if we had a few years, we might be able to save civilization at that level.
Yeah, suppose we blow up the asteroid that's going to kill us. So what's next?
The next major disaster is likely to be the fact that the sun is actually getting brighter with time. It was about 20% less bright than it is now when life first evolved on Earth. And we know in about 2 billion years, it will become about 15 to 20% brighter. Now, when that happens, what will happen is there'll be a runaway greenhouse effect, just like happened on Venus, we believe, several billion years ago. Venus is the way it is because it's just a little bit closer to the sun than we are. And what happens is the sun heats up the water evaporates. Water vapor is a greenhouse gas, and it causes the system to get hotter, and then more water evaporates, and you get a runaway effect, and all the water on Venus evaporated and eventually left the atmosphere, and it became so hot that the surface temperature of Venus is greater than about 1,000 degrees. When the sun reaches about 15% greater luminosity than it has now, greater brightness than it has now, the Earth will be in the zone in which there will be a runaway greenhouse effect, just like Venus. Hmm. Now, maybe there will be some technological fix for that. Maybe we can put a big umbrella over the atmosphere, or in fact, I have great confidence that we might be able to do something like that. So maybe we can save ourselves at least 2 billion years in the future. But then 5 billion years in the future, the sun will burn up its hydrogen fuel. Then you might think it would go out like a candle burns out in the dark, but in fact it will do exactly the opposite. The inside of the sun will start to shrink, and it'll get hotter, and the outside of the sun will puff up, and eventually the sun will become what's called a red giant, and the size of the sun will be such that it will actually encompass the Earth's orbit. Now, the Earth will, during the process, actually get pushed out a little bit, but it's hard to imagine at that point much you can do to save the Earth.
So at that point, we better have those spaceships ready so we can start voyaging into other areas.
Exactly. In fact, at that point, one hopes if we have a civilization that survives that long, since we know it's coming, we'll be able to have spaceships ready, or maybe we'll be able to colonize Mars, for example, as the simplest alternative. There's lots of alternatives. The end of the sun and the end of the Earth do not have to mean the end of life.
But if the sun disappears, then there's no point in colonizing Mars, is there?
But the sun will be bright for a while longer in its new form, and Mars will be farther away, and we could live on there for a while. But you're right, when the sun stops providing power, then there's no point in staying on Mars, and the real point is to build a roving, self-contained spaceship that either supplies its own power by taking in starlight or by using the magnetic fields of the galaxy, or where we eventually just move on and colonize some other world. I mean, all of this is science fiction. But I think the ultimate future of life, if it is going to have a future, is to imagine becoming wandering travelers. And in fact, you know, that's the history of life on Earth. If you think about it in the past, groups have left where they were, where they, you know, were apparently comfortable, to go out on difficult and long voyages with the potential never to return. It's happened throughout human history, and people have done it when wherever they were became unbearable, either for political or religious reasons or economic reasons or something else. And eventually, our future is in the stars. But, you know, in a way, that's kind of poetic if you want to bring it back to the beginning, because we came from the stars. Every atom in our bodies was once inside a star that exploded. In fact, the atoms in your left arm may be from a different star than the atoms in your right arm. We literally are stardust. Every atom in our bodies, the elements that make the oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, all the things that make life possible were all created in the stars. So we know that we came from the stars and we'll just eventually head back out there.
Lawrence Krauss is the author of Atom and an astrophysicist at Case Western Reserve University. Most of us won't be around to see the galaxy fade away, so we'll just have to be satisfied with science fiction. Shows like Star Trek do more than show us what the future looks like. They also give us an idea what it sounds like. Ron Sadoff teaches film music studies at New York University. He told Anne Strangechamps about one of the first best examples of science fiction music.
Doctor Who is an English series. The original theme, I think, is 1963. And there was a kind of a rock version of it in 1980, which really is not that much different to my ears, except it has kind of more of the synthesized sounds that were used at that time. But it has this mechanized gestures underneath, which is almost like telegraph or perhaps almost like signals coming from outer space.
High-pitched wailing sound, I assume, is the theremin.
Mm-hmm. Well, theremin is an instrument you actually never touch. One hand controls volume and one controls pitch, and it's very hard to control the pitch and the volume at the same time.
The whole thing has this kind of, I guess it must have been made in the 60s, right? Because it's got this kind of 60s early rock and roll kind of version of science fiction sound.
That's right, and if you listen to the 1980 version, it has more of the dance beats. And there's kind of that mechanized feeling, and also sometimes even a feeling of inevitability, you know, where something's moving. Very often you have the bass underneath of dance music, which might go boom, 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 and then it repeats again. The music's almost created a little bit like the Vegematic. It slices, dices, cuts onions so fast you don't get a chance to cry. Also, a lot of the sounds of, echo, yep, that kind of thing can also be mimetic of kind of deep space, if you will.
The idea of sound fading away into vast distances.
That's right. Or these reverbs that are cavernous and, you know, makes us feel that we're someplace else.
All of these also seem to have a kind of creepy feeling to them.
Well, that's the theremin. If you listen to the Spellbound example, this is almost theremin in its purest sense. This film is Hollywood melodrama, 1945. The theremin is really used for psychological terror. Gregory Peck has amnesia and the disorientation that we hear. And then immediately following that, it's juxtaposed with, you know, standard Hollywood traditional love music.
What is it about the theremin that produces that kind of the particular psychological feeling that it does?
I think it sounds like the human voice, first of all, yet it is not the human voice. And this is, I think, the beauty of music, and what makes music also emotional is the fact that it's ambiguous. It would be a much different thing if it was a human voice singing that. You even hear it more so in The Day the Earth Stood Still, a Bernard Herrmann score from 1951. And the theremin here, it's used in the lower range, and it sounds almost like a contralto. It's much more like a human voice here. But you get, with his music underneath, which is all orchestral, this feeling of inevitability of death and doom.
You know, it's really interesting. Every example we've played so far projects this vision of the future or of, you know, outer space as a very unsettling, pretty creepy kind of place. Are there ever any more positive, you know, kind of major key, triumphant, happy kind of versions of being in space or of time travel or any of this stuff?
Doctor Who is television, and a lot of television you get lower budgets to create music in the first place, so it tends to be more grassroots. I think also if you look at Spellbound and The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is were done really before television, it was an event to go to the movies. A lot of the movies were really palatial, and it was a real experience. But the antithesis that happens once we hit Star Wars, John Williams' seminal score of 75, I believe, we end up using huge orchestral renderings of science fiction, and they tend to be very heroic, almost swashbuckling, and they have their own language too. In this next example, the Star Trek theme from Star Trek the movie, this is a score by Jerry Goldsmith. This is quite a bit different from the Star Trek theme from the 60s, and also that's what makes it so difficult to write something that's really memorable and, you know, powerful at once, and it's all very major key. And we're exploring, we're pioneers.
You know, it's interesting because this one, it's almost like our focus, our lens has switched so that instead of focusing on outer space and the aliens, here we're focused on humans, the human beings who are going out to space and, you know, the music implies going to master whatever we find out there.
Yeah, it does seem to be that way. And I think they are set up, that Star Wars is certainly set up that way. And the characters are very mythological. It's not so cultish like the television shows like X-Files and Doctor Who, because you're not seeing these films all the time.
Well, you teach film music studies at NYU. If you were going to give an assignment to a class full of students and tell them to craft a theme for a good contemporary science fiction television show, what kind of things would they need to think about?
They would have to first think about the sounds they're going to use. The way modern-day synthesizers and digital sampling modules work is they're packed with huge libraries of sounds. And very often a student or a composer will take one of those sounds, will play it, and sometimes that will actually trigger thoughts. There's also, back to this idea of loops, where There's many of these sampling CDs where you press one note on a keyboard and you get a whole, you know, that's repetitive, and there's hundreds of them. So they tend to collage these type elements. I would suggest that they use certain elements if they want to go by the convention. And this is where it gets tricky, because it's easy to take these elements we've spoken of and write the convention of futuristic music like Doctor Who, which is just simply imitative and could be indeed cliché. What's tricky is to take a genre and come up with something really new. That's what's much more difficult to do. People that do this, like Ennio Morricone, if you think of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, it's a Western, yet it's completely different than anything had been done before, yet it has elements of the Western.
Is there any science fiction music out there that breaks the mold in that way, that, you know, goes beyond the conventions?
Well, I think as far as going behind the conventions, I would say this is not now, but certainly 2001 of Kubrick, you know, where he takes the Blue Danube, and that music, which has absolutely nothing to do with deep space, is very, very much now coded with deep space. When you hear the Blue Danube, you see this kind of floating in space, this choreography. It's very connected with it.
Ron Sedoff teaches film music studies at New York University. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Coming up, the future's closer than you think. Stay tuned for a peek at the technology, trends, and customs that might just change the world. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. One nice thing about the future is it never arrives. We can speculate about computer domination and planet creation all we want, from a safe distance. In his book A Brief History of Tomorrow, Jonathan Margolis says, people have been predicting the future for ages, but we almost never get it right. Still, doesn't stop companies like Britain's Orange from trying.
They're talking about having a cell phone effectively implanted in your ear as an ear stud, which will run your life. It will wake you up in the morning. It'll read you your emails while you're in the shower. It'll tell you what the traffic's like on the way to work. It'll arrange multilingual translated conferences for you while you're walking along the street or sitting on the train going to work. I think they've got it wrong. I don't think anybody wants that.
Well, it sounds a little like Big Brother as your servant, but still Big Brother.
Yeah. It's a lot like Big Brother. And there is an overexcited tendency. I'm just looking in front of me here to a report. One of the world's most famous futurologists, a guy called Ian Pearson, who was saying publicly that by 2010, the world's highest earning actors and pop stars and models will be synthetic celebrity bots with artificial voice personality generated by a computer and so on. I would be tempted to say that won't happen. It may be possible for that to happen, although I even doubt that. But there is a consumer resistance.
There are other things where people seem to be fascinated with the idea of merging technology and our bodies. Is that really beginning to happen?
I don't think it's beginning to happen. I'd be a little surprised if it has. I was just reading a piece in one of our more sort of trend-oriented magazines, and it was saying that one of the quote coolest things for 2002 is not to be contactable, and gave a list of celebrities and big hitters in corporate life who don't carry a cell phone or a beeper or anything else, because it's a way of showing what a big cheese you are by being completely uncontactable.
Well, there are thousands of people all over the world who are already ahead of them in that.
Yeah, they're the people who've done it by never having had a cell phone in the first place. But beware of denigrating the importance of the cell phone in countries that never had a proper telephone network. I mean, all over the third world, cell phones are enormously important.
Well, and for a lot of people, it is still desirable to have that, is what you're saying. People want the ability to communicate.
But the further reaches at the kind of the urban extreme becoming untouchable, unreachable, is showing signs of becoming something desirable again. So I think there will always be this pull against these personal, intrusive technologies. And one of the areas I think we're going to really rebel against is artificial intelligence. Now, we're told to the point of boredom that by 2015 we'll have computers that are as intelligent or more intelligent and creative than human beings. Now, first of all, I think this is a gross example of what I call in the book the arrogance of the present. I think we hopelessly underestimate the human brain. I mean, no less an authority than Stephen Hawking has pointed out that the largest and most powerful Cray supercomputer in the world has the equivalent intelligence currently of an earthworm. And he suggested that by 2005 it might be approaching the intelligence of a mouse, the real intelligence. It does things fast, but it's not smart in the sense that we are.
But we have always worried, too, about those supercomputers and whether they will enslave us in the future. I mean, that's part of the apocalyptic vision, too, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't buy it. Again, you know, look at robots. We are supposed to be in the age of robots now. They're supposed to be clanking and crunching around our homes, doing the dusting and making the coffee. And in a sense, they are. The average home has several robots working away, you know, turning the heating on and off, micro robots doing little chores, turning the washing machine on and off and up and down and so on. But as for the clanking, clunking, two-legged, bipedal headed version, there's just no call for it. If it did exist, it would be too creepy, really, to have moving around the house, doing things. Even though they've perfected, at last, a robot which can climb stairs, it couldn't even begin to climb stairs while holding a cup of coffee.
What about medical advances? One of the predictions that I know you wrote about was that at one point they thought there would be head transplants. Now, there are times when I'm tired of looking at myself in the mirror, but that's not a terribly appealing idea for most people, is it?
Well, yeah, but if I offered you a body transplant, you might feel slightly different. If I had an old, tired body that I, you know, was really rather fed up with, and somebody like, say, Mike Tyson had one going spare, I would be probably quite happy to to have my head sewn onto the top of it. You know, they appear to be kind of comic book joke questions, but they're really not. You know what? The most extraordinary thing that happened in the 20th century was the extension of lifespan. At the beginning of the century, lifespan was something like 43. By the end of the century, it was over 70. Those are international figures. But the fact that people don't regard themselves as old at 40 anymore, they don't regard themselves old at 50 or 60, is probably one of the most significant things we've done to ourselves as a species. Anybody over 34 or 35 is, I think, technically speaking, is the living dead. We're not supposed to live beyond that point, let alone have our first children at that point, as is now the norm in Western urban society. So, yes, medical advances have probably been the most remarkable of all. And yet, if I were asked to say what will be the shape of medicine in this coming century, I think you might see a very different kind of medicine. I was talking to somebody the other day who believed that placebo, the controlled use of placebo, in other words, drugs that aren't drugs, are going to be the big, big growth area. A lot of things that are now almost a bit way out will be demystified. Not so much legitimized, but simply demystified in the next 100 years.
You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is that, you know, almost all of the predictions about the future that you look at from 50 years ago or 100 years ago, there was a lot of talk of outer space. You know, 40 years ago, we talked about picnicking on the moon. And somehow outer space has, it's receded.
It's receded, and yet I found nobody in all my researches on the future, nobody who didn't feel that moving our sights out to the outer planets and outer galaxies would not be the core of the future. I mean, it seems to be a given that we will continue the exploration of outer space. And I've predicted in the book, for example, that this will carry unthought of social implications. Say the Americans or somebody establishes a base on Mars, as everybody says they will. And you know, slowly we're working towards that. It's easy to get impatient, but it's kind of happening bit by bit. Say there's then a generation born on Mars. I see a kind of a similarity with the beginnings of the United States, where we had the Boston Tea Party, when suddenly the people born in the USA, or we'll say for the purpose of this argument, the Martian Americans, they'll accept that they came to be on Mars because of the efforts of the American taxpayer. But why would they want to carry on paying their taxes back to Earth? Maybe they're going to start thinking like post-colonialists and want independence from the Earth. You know, it's not their fault. They didn't ask to be born on Mars. They just were. There are also fascinating things that could happen because of the lower gravitational force on Mars. You know, the way on submarines people eat really well, it's always been part of submariner life, is that you feed the sailors really well, because it kind of, you know, it combats the boredom of being underwater for months at a time. You could eat whatever you like on Mars. It wouldn't matter how fat you got, because you'd only weigh half or a third what you weigh on Earth. So I can see a generation of fat and rebellious Martian Americans in 100 years from now.
Do you have a favorite prediction for the future? I mean, you've looked at a lot of them by now.
Favorite prediction for the future? Yes, I think one of the fun things that's going to happen, or funny things that's going to happen over the next 100 years, is an increasing premium is going to be placed by the middle class, the literati, the intelligentsia, on anything kind of handmade and real, as manufactured products become cheaper and better and more reliable. I think we're all going to want to have spots on our organic apples and badly made plates with finger marks in the glazing. And it's a sort of a Joni Mitchell vision, really, from the big, was it, which song was it that she celebrated, you know, give me spots on my apples, but leave the DDT alone, the beginning of the sort of organic movement. I think we're going to want real everything. And I think it's going to culminate in when virtual reality, if virtual reality ever takes off, and sort of cyber sex over the internet in sort of rubber jumpsuits, a synthetic experience of sex becomes readily available, and synthetic holidays as well. I think people are going to get very, very snobby about the fact, oh, we have real sex. We have real holidays in real places. We don't go for the cheap, mass-produced cyber version.
Jonathan Margolis covers new technology for the Financial Times and the Evening Standard. His book is called A Brief History of Tomorrow.
In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 4545, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew, nobody's gonna look at you.
If you think you've got a decent grasp of the English language, well, guess again. A crash course on the Dictionary of the Future when we come back. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. It can be a little embarrassing to fall behind the times, to be the only one at your church potluck to tell someone their tea cozy is cool when the latest word is slammin'. Well, To the Best of Our Knowledge wants to keep you up to date, and so here's a primer for you on the words, terms, and trends that define the way we'll live, work, and talk, courtesy of Dictionary of the Future.
Walkie.
Armpit art, the coolest in streetwear from Japan, involving glitter and paintings.
Culinambulator,
a person who eats on the run. See also bun and run and hash and dash.
Infophobia,
a fear of being incompletely informed. Any sentence beginning with the words, "Do you know?" will cause an infophobic to experience accelerated heartbeat and panic symptoms.
Admir envy.
A common feeling that blends admiration and envy. A writer who reads a terrific book by another writer feels admirenvy.
Lunch lob.
The cowardly practice of returning a dreaded phone call at lunch when everybody's out of the office.
Wordburger.
The grinding of perfectly good words into chopped meat. Bush is a chief offender.
Manny's.
A new label for the onslaught of domestic and foreign-born male nannies.
No fly zone.
The millennial version of don't go there.
Did you catch all that? Adam Hanft is the co-author of Dictionary of the Future. Steve Paulson wondered where the new words come from.
Well, there are about two-thirds of the words that are already out there that we gleaned from the culture, and about one-third of the terms are neologisms or invented words. Each chapter is divided in half, and we've got, in the beginning of each chapter, the words that we found in the culture, and then the last third or so are the words that were invented.
There are a lot of words that you've either coined or you've found out there that have to do with demographics, especially with the baby boomers. I liked baboons, for instance.
Right. Baby boomers without savings. I think that there are 78 million baby boomers, and they're the largest demographic group ever to move through the country. And as a result, the changes are pretty substantial that they are affecting. And as they get older, there's going to be major changes as well, because we know that the baby boomers are a very privileged and self-involved group, cohort, as it's called, and they will approach their aging in different ways than their predecessors. One of the things that we've been looking at is where they will retire to. And what we've said is rather than retiring to traditional kind of sun and fun locales, they will be looking for what we've coined as yogurt cities, and that is cities with active cultures.
You also suggest another baby boomer activity might be plastic surgery cruises.
Right. Actually, USA Today picked that up, and they did an illustration for their article on the book on what a plastic surgery cruise might look like. And the thought there is to combine some recreation, some rest, with some face work at the same time. So by the time you come back, your black and blue marks have been healed, and you look doubly rested.
Though I have to say, there's something kind of repulsive about some of these things that you're talking about.
Well, some of them are, let's say, intentionally provocative in order to extrapolate out a trend and see where it might go. And as we say in the introduction, we really make no claim at objectivity here. And we do want to stir the pot and get people thinking about what the consequences of some of these trends might be, so that they can understand where things are going with hopefully a clarity that they might not bring to it otherwise.
Do you have any favorite new words?
Well, there's a couple of that I think, both from a kind of a tongue-in-cheek point of view and from a deeper point of view, are interesting. One of them is when you call an 800 number and you're just stuck going from hit 2, hit 3, hit pound, you're in voice jail. And voice jail just seems to perfectly sum up what much of customer service is like today. Another piece of language that is interesting is, and this we picked up in a couple of places, is karaoke managers. Well, a karaoke manager is somebody who gets ahead simply by sitting in a meeting and mouthing in a slightly different way what the person before them has just said.
I think we've all seen that.
We've all seen that. And, you know, the beauty of some of these terms is they just hit exactly the right chord. And we all smile and laugh like voice jail because we know what it is. And it might seem strange for dictionaries to be coining words. But if you look back into the history of dictionary making, there was in the 16th century and after, a number of lexicographers who set about to invent words because they thought the English language was starved of language compared to, let's say, the French. So words like democracy, for example, and ambition were coined by someone named Sir Thomas Eliot, who had a dictionary back in the 16th century. So it's interesting that is a historical reality that very few of us know. And whenever somebody says, you have some nerve inventing words, we go back to Sir Thomas Eliot.
Adam Hanft and Faith Popcorn are the authors of the Dictionary of the Future. They, wait a second. I think I forgot to check my messages.
Hi, Jim. It's Doug. I just need to talk. pick up if you're there. You know, Jim, I have been feeling a lot of admirer envy about the radical changes my friends are making, all of them. They're making all these big changes in their lives, and it's got me thinking that it's time for a Mequel. I'm tired of being a karaoke manager, a culinambulator, and an infophobic. So I've made a very important decision. That is it. No more lunch lobs, voice jail, and napkining Mr. Vandelay's coffee spills. I am relocating to one of those yogurt cities. Maybe I'll get some walkie and become a Manny. So what if I'm a baboon? Better to be a baboon than a corporate chimp.
If for something that doesn't even exist, time travel shows a lot of staying power. I mean, listen to this.
Ah, jeez, Doc, you disintegrated Einstein.
Calm down, Marty, I didn't disintegrate anything. The molecular structure of both Einstein and the car are completely intact.
Where the hell are they?
The appropriate question is, when the hell are they? You see, Einstein has just become the world's first time traveler. I sent him into the future.
Time, the fourth dimension. The ultimate mystery. The ultimate prison. Time fleeing away from us like sand escaping from a ruptured hourglass. Fleeing, flying, fading away. Leaving us with all our yesterdays, all our stillborn plans and ambitions. Nothing but wreckage on the vast and indifferent sea of time. But I have sailed that sea, charted those unchartable depths. Call me the time traveler, for that is what I am.
If physicist Ronald Mallett is right, time travel might one day be as universally accepted as cell phones and spaceflight. Mallett says the whole concept is based on Einstein's theory of relativity, so even the most dubious scientist should take the possibility of travel through time seriously. He told Anne Strangechamps, all you need is something to bend the fabric of space. And Mallett thinks he's got just the thing. Light.
What Einstein's theory tells us is that not only matter can affect space and time, but energy. Light does not have matter. Well, in fact, just by its name. But light has energy. So that means that light can affect space and time just like matter can. There is a device that's called a laser, which is a highly intense thin beam of light. And what I have suggested is that since Einstein's theory says that time can be affected by light as well as by matter, that if you have a light beam that is circulating, like, for example, suppose that you have a set of mirrors that you just can cause the light beam to just sort of move around in a circle, okay? Mm-hmm. You can arrange things so that that can happen. Now, what will happen is that this light beam will create a gravitational field. This gravitational field will actually cause a twisting of space. To give you an analogy, what that's like is that suppose you have a cup of coffee and you pour your cream into it and you stir it. Okay, if you think of the coffee itself as being space, well, this light beam is going to cause space to just swirl around. And in addition to that,
so the light beam is like the spoon.
Exactly, the light beam is like the spoon, and it will cause space to twist around. And if you put anything into space, you would get the odd effect of anything that was in empty space would get dragged around by the circulating light beam. Okay. And now, what I have shown is that not only does this twisting of space occur, but a twisting of time occurs. We think of time normally as you can think of it as a straight line. For example, a line that goes from the past. You can think of another point on the line that's the present. And then at the end of the line, you can think of it as being the future. That's the way we normally think of time intuitively. Now, imagine that you were able to twist that line. You were able to take that line and make it a circle.
Mm-hmm.
So that now you could see what could happen. You could go from the past to the present to the future. But now since this line is now a circle, that means you could go from the future into the past. And so this circulating light beam would cause a twisting of space and a twisting of time and would cause time to close into a loop. And this closing of time into a loop, in fact, these closed loops of time are what physicists mean when they talk about time travel into the past. That's represented by closed loops in time so that you could go from the future into the past.
how real could this be? I mean, it's a great theory. The images are beautiful and exciting. But, I mean, could this actually work?
Well, the thing is that one could verify it in stages. In other words, the first prediction, which doesn't require as much energy, is will it cause a twisting of space? Because these things are connected. And that, in fact, is something that at the University of Connecticut we're presently going to be trying to write up a proposal to verify. That is to say, there are types of devices called photonic crystals. These are crystals that can trap and channel light. These are real crystals that exist. The theory of these things have been worked out in the 90s, and it's still an exploding field. It eventually will enter into computers and so on. But in any case, my theory, and this was published a couple of years ago, shows that the circulating light should cause little particles, like, for instance, neutrons, which are little teeny spinning gyroscope-type particles, that if they are in this circulating light beam, they should get twisted around in the empty space created by the light beam.
So you can actually test this to see whether the neutrons really are moving forward or back in time.
That's right. So it will be possible to verify this by using, and it's what's nice is that we have this current technology, like these photonic crystals, which will allow the possibility of verification.
Okay, well now sort of extrapolate far into the future, assuming you've, you know, tested this with neutrons and with, I don't know, increasingly large particles. I mean, someday can you imagine a huge, gigantic laser beam and a person could somehow, what, ride on a stream of light back into the past or forward into the future?
One can imagine is that suppose you had a large enough circulating laser beam that was intense enough, then a person that was in the region, they didn't want to come close, they don't want to touch the edges of the laser beam, they would get vaporized. But if they're anywhere within that region, the space will become twisted and time will become twisted, and they should be able to go back into the past. They should be able to ride space and move back into the past.
Could you go much further back? I mean, for instance, how could you manage to go back to a time before this device existed? And could you go back to the 16th century, the 15th century?
Not in the way in which this, unless some other advanced civilization had already produced one of these devices centuries ago, and we encounter that, you would not be able to go back beyond the time that the machine was turned on. And as a matter of fact, that answers one of the objections that sometimes people have raised, which is, why haven't we seen time travelers already? And that is that the first time machine hasn't been built. So, for example, suppose that we built our first time machine today and we left it turned on for 100 years. A person 100 years from now in the 22nd century could come back to our time, but they couldn't come back to the period earlier than the time that the machine was turned on.
But do you mean once, if we turned this on, we might suddenly start receiving visitors from the future who would be coming back to here? Wow.
Exactly. Exactly. That could be a real possibility.
That's just mind-blowing. So is this the kind of thing you think about? I mean, do you ever sort of sit around and just dream and imagine what kind of visitors we'd get?
Well, the thing is that I wonder what our future would hold for us, because I would like to think that what we would get visitors that would come back and tell us how to do things right in our time. But it is an interesting thing. I mean, my original intent, of course, for this machine was a little bit more personal, so it doesn't quite do what I would have wanted to do. I was motivated originally, my interest in time travel, by the death of my father when I was 10 years old. He died of a heart attack, and I think I could have become a depressed little kid because I loved him very deeply. But at that time, I loved science fiction, and I read H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine, and that actually became my inspiration, my holy grail. My notion was that what if I could build a time machine and go back and tell my father what he needed to do to live, that I might save his life. So for me, the whole purpose of being interested in time travel was that personal interest of trying to save my father's life. But with this type of machine, of course, I wouldn't be able to do that.
So you didn't figure out a way to make a time machine that would let you do what you'd originally wanted, to go back and see your father again. Do you think there is any possible way that could be done? I mean, using physics, or is that just that's impossible?
Well, the thing is that I believe in human ingenuity, and I believe that the limitations of this particular type of device, I don't see easily how that can be overcome, but it may perhaps be overcome. And the other thing is I know it sounded as though it's even more science fiction, but remember I mentioned the fact that if there was another advanced civilization somewhere else that had developed time travel long before, you know, our civilization even was crawling out of the caves. Once we have space flight and once we're able to travel to distant planetary systems on other worlds, I believe that we will encounter civilizations that have had these advanced techniques available. If they had already produced the machine, imagine now that there was some advanced civilization that we encounter that had produced time travel, let's say, a million years ago. I mean, they were just that far ahead of us in their evolution. Then we could use their machine to go back to any particular time in our past. So it's possible if that happens. But, you know, that's one of those things that, you know, first you would have to find an advanced civilization and assume that they had developed time travel that distant past. But that could occur. As you can tell, I'm a fan of Star Trek and then some of their scenarios, that sort of thing does happen.
Well, so I guess what you have to do is build your time machine, take yourself in it far enough into the future that we might by then, through, you know, several more hundred years of space travel, found that advanced civilization. And then you can use their time machine to go back into our own past.
I love it. That's a great story. And yes, that would be the sort of thing that I would hope for.
Ronald Millette is a physicist at the University of Connecticut. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Facing the Future, number 23B. If you have questions or comments on the show, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us an email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.